And at this point, I'll turn it over to Guy to start the meeting.
Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm the president of National Capital Astronomers, and this is our February meeting. If you were for someplace else,
Hello, Guy. Excuse me. This is Mike Evans. I'm not getting your video.
Yeah,
I'm not getting this video.
I'm having.
We're not getting yours either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Mike Babansky has his video turned off. I can see and hear Guy. So,
yeah, so
Mike, if you don't see Guy, then that is a problem on your end, because I do see Guy. His video is working.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well. Okay. So I would like to have a motion. So
you are breaking up a bit, Guy. So you may want to just turn off your video to save yourself some bandwidth.
Okay, I'm having some severe technical difficulties. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
You're probably not doing anything wrong. It's just bandwidth.
Guy, I can hear you fine, or I can see you fine. You're sometimes your audio breaks up a little bit, but just stay close to the mic and you should be able to be working okay.
Okay. The motion I would like to do before we start the meeting is pretty simple. We resolve that the National Capital Astronomers of the DC's need to address significant overlighting of our city at light at night, wholeheartedly support the city's engagement with Lights Out Hour DC. For 1 hour on March 30 to 9:30 p.m., the NCA encourages the shutting off or dimming of all non-essential lights visible from the outside. So that's the motion. I've discussed this in my president's corner, and I was wondering if we could have any discussion on this issue and then bring this formal vote. Is there any opposition to this?
I'll second it.
I move that we pass it by acclamation.
No, we need discussion.
Okay.
First off, the actual motion wasn't very clear because you broke up several times.
I apologize for that. There's nothing out there. And not only that, I can't get back into.
We've lost you, Guy.
Okay. Let's see. So let me try that again.
Wow, this computer is doing the same thing as the other one did.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
You're green.
Okay, I'm going to kill my audio.
No.
Okay, sweet. I don't know if that's any better. Now I want to do a chat to everybody, but of course I can't do it to everybody because I can only do it back to Jim Simpson.
No, you can do the drop down and select everybody. Normally,
but if I type it in here, then that's
it's written in the Jim Simpson. It's written in the president's corner.
Yes.
In
clear language.
Okay, so that's clear.
It says the DC chapter of the International Dark Sky Association is asking all DC residents and institutions who care about the environment to turn off all non-essential outdoor lighting for 1 hour during the evening of March 25th, 2023.
And who are we making this request? Like, where are you?
Well, if that's a motion, I second it.
It would be between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m. on a Saturday.
Where is this in D.C.? Where is it?
It says asking all D.C. residents.
So where are you going to be submitting this to? Like, we make this motion or we approve it, but then what? Who are you submitting the request to? Are we putting in an ad into a paper? Are we?
Okay, I vote yes.
Oh, guy disappeared. All right, he's back again.
Disappeared.
He should be back now.
I assume this applies to the Maryland and Virginia suburbs too.
Yeah, I think so.
I would like to suggest an amendment that we request that members of NCA honor this. Rather than we make it to the whole city, we just request that members of NCA participate.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Well, that's 93 people out of a local population of several million.
Yes, but the International Dark Sky Association is making this request to the whole country.
And how is it being publicized to the other people in the capital area?
That's their problem. That's their problem. That's not our problem.
Well, the problem actually is to try to judge out. That's the problem.
We could put it as a letter to the editor and Post.
Yeah.
Well, good.
Bethesda's gotten really bad with the new Marriott. I mean, it's just like you can see half the stars that you used to be able to see. So I think aiming it at large places like the Marriott and people that have those huge signs might do better than just individual people.
Can I hear me? Can anybody hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Intermittently.
Oh, Lord. Yes, it's a big problem. It's not just the District of Columbia. Most people right now cannot see the Milky Way at all. And they have no idea what they're missing. And the important thing is, I think, to get the word out. So I think I just sent something in chat to everybody.
Yes.
We got it.
Okay. So I'm trying to do my part to contact my congressman, my city council person, and locutions. And
as I said, if you maybe put something, a letter to the editor in the Post, that would get widespread notice.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to draft a letter to the Washington Post, Jay? We have quite a few things that could be done. And not enough.
So Guy?
Yes.
Whichever organization is the primary organization probably has a media packet. You should try to get a copy or hold of that media packet, because they've probably already prepared a bunch of material that can be used in support of it, which probably includes things like graphics that we can put on the website, things like that.
Yeah, well, we're working on that.
We don't have to do it. We shouldn't have to do anything. I bet that the primary organization organizing the Earth Hour is nothing new. Earth Hour has been going on for 20 some years.
Correct.
Earth Hour has been around a long time. So they probably already have media materials prepared.
Yes, and I've linked to quite a few of those things in my article. Can I simply state that NCA officially supports Earth Hour and the dimming or turning off of non-essential lights in DC and vicinity formally, so we can go on record as one of the organizations supporting official Earth Hour? That's what I would like.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, is there anybody opposed to NCA supporting Earth Hour 2023? Okay. Can I have a show of hands? You can, down in reactions at the bottom of the screen, you can raise your hand to support or do a thumbs up on that. Or thumbs down.
It'll be better if they do check marks, because the hands up disappear pretty quickly. So there's a green check mark or a red X. And please only register or paid up members. Okay. Okay. I don't know what it takes to make a quorum, but you got 17 approvals, 18 approvals.
Okay, thank you very much. And I am really sorry for the bad connection.
And the Dunham's also approved, but we can't figure out how to raise our hand.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, and
I think it's generally passed.
Yeah, and some people have raised their hands.
Thank you very much.
On the video only.
Okay, I'm turning off my video. And
okay,
so I'm going to turn this over to Hornstein Point.
Okay, and so now to uncheck, you can just click that little check mark to unmark yourself.
Okay.
No, I can't.
Okay, it's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Dr. Thaddeus Komacek, Assistant Professor in the Department of Astronomy at the University of Maryland at College Park. He has bachelor's degrees in both geophysical sciences and in physics from the University of Chicago, and a PhD in planetary sciences from the University of Arizona Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. His dissertation was on the atmospheric circulation and evolution of close-in extrasolar gas giant planets. So his focus on hot Jupiter exoplanets is of long standing. After his PhD, Tad held a Heising-Simmings 51 Pegasi B postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Chicago from 2018 to 2021. Now, it's singularly appropriate that his postdoctoral fellowship was named after 51 Pegasi b, because this was the first exoplanet discovered to be orbiting a main sequence star. And that star even turned out to be a sun-like star. This exoplanet was also the one that showed that there exists the class of planets that are now called hot Jupiters. And astoundingly, this hot Jupiter even has water vapor in its atmosphere. Dr. Komachek's research focuses on characterizing the atmospheres of exoplanets by developing theoretical and numerical models for their global circulation and climate. But in addition to research on the atmospheres of hot Jupiters, his research has included their oceans and interiors. He's also done research on rocky exoplanets, including the search for Earth-like exoplanets. Together with Kwansi Ye, who was our speaker last September, Professor Komachek also runs the Planetary and Exoplanetary Astronomy Lunch Seminar series talks at the University of Maryland. And this series brings in researchers who've made significant recent discoveries about planets and exoplanets to talk about what they've found. In addition to his research, throughout his career, he's contributed to the education of future astronomers via the National Science Olympiad astronomy events for high school students. This evening, Professor Komachek will tell us about what we have learned and what we can learn about the atmospheric circulation and climate of exoplanets in the era of the spectacular new James Webb Space Telescope. Dr. Komachek.
Well, thank you very much for the kind and comprehensive introduction, John. I'll share my screen. All right, can everybody see the slides?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, so today I'll be speaking on our current understanding of the atmospheres of exoplanets and how this will be advanced and has already been advanced over the past 9 months or so in the era of JWST. And so this work has been done with many, many people from across the country and around the world. But most of my closest collaborators are either at the University of Maryland or NASA Goddard. And so, as I'm sure many of you know, at this point, there's been over 5,000 exoplanets discovered using a variety of different types of detection methods. Here I'm just showing you a cumulative detection plot of exoplanets over time. And you can see in recent years, there's really been an explosion in the detection rate of exoplanets, largely driven by the investment by NASA and ESA to launch observatories that can find planets via transit. However, the first planet was found using the radial velocity method, the first planet orbiting a sun-like star. The first exoplanets were actually discovered orbiting a pulsar using the pulsar timing method in 1992, but the pulsar planets have not been followed up in detail, and they're more or less anomalies. There's been only 7 planets found around pulsars, but at this point there's been, around 1,025 planets found through the radial velocity method, most of which orbit sun-like stars. And so practically speaking, the radial velocity method infers the presence of a planet through its gravitational influence on the motion of its host star around the star-planet barycenter. And so what we actually observe are the Doppler shifts of the host light in our line of sight. And so this plot on the left is showing the detection curve of the planet 51 Pegasi b by measuring the radial velocity shifts of the host star 51 Pegasi. And you can see this is a nice sinusoid with an amplitude of around 50 meters per second, quite large. Earth's amplitude on this same plot would be on the order of 10 centimeters per second. And so from the amplitude, you can infer the minimum mass of the planet. And from the period, you can infer the period. And then using Kepler's third law, you can get this axis. And the observations implied that the planet that was causing the shift was a hot Jupiter exoplanet, the first of its class, with a mass of at least half a Jupiter mass and a semi-major axis of 0.05 astronomical units. And so this planet must have an atmospheric temperature that exceeds 1,000 Kelvin. This observation was done by Didier Queloz and Michel Mayor, and they shared half the 2019 Nobel Prize in Physics for this discovery. And this was just the first of many, many discoveries using this method, which is known as the radial velocity method. However, the most prolific method that has been used to find planets to date is the transit method, which is fairly intuitive. You infer the presence of a planet due to its impact on the host star's light via photometry. You see physically in the light curve a decrease in the host star's light as the planet occults the star, and a corresponding increase again as the planet occultation finishes. And from the dip of the host star light due to the planet, you can infer the relative size of the planet compared to that of the star. And with good enough stellar models, you can then directly infer the size of the planet. And there's been two major missions launched by NASA to find planets via the transit method. The first one, and the most prolific, was the Kepler mission, which was launched in 2009 and finished its lifetime in 2018. And during its primary mission, Kepler stared for about 4 years in a field of view that was adjacent to the Cygnus constellation. And effectively, while staring at this one patch of sky, Kepler studied the light curves of over 150,000 main sequence sun-like stars to search for transit events. And through this process, found over 2,000 planets. However, Kepler lost the ability to point very precisely in space because it lost two of its reaction wheels over its first 4 years of its lifetime. And so Kepler was repurposed as the K2 mission starting in 2015, where it instead just scanned the ecliptic in 38 patches and still found many, many more planets during the K2 mission. The present mission that is used to study planets using the transit method is TESS, which was launched in 2018 and is still ongoing. And TESS is the first all-sky survey just searching for exoplanets. It does so by scanning sectors in the northern hemisphere and then flipping and scanning sectors in the southern hemisphere. It scans 13 sectors in each hemisphere for 27 days per sector, basically spending 1 year studying each hemisphere at a time. And so TESS now at this point is wrapping up its fourth year studying the southern hemisphere for the second time. And over its mission lifetime, TESS has found 287 planets that are confirmed, that is seen by other detection methods as well. And it has more than 6,000 planet candidates that require follow-up to confirm that they are truly a planet and not a false positive. And the discoveries by Kepler and TESS have really shown that our solar system is likely not a typical planetary system. So here I'm going to show you the Kepler orrery. This is Ethan Cruz's version of the Kepler orrery from 2012, near the end of the primary Kepler mission. So this is going to show you orbits of all of the planets found by Kepler as of the time of making this movie, where the size of the planet corresponds to their radius, and the color of the planet corresponds to their equilibrium temperature, that is the temperature that you would expect the planet to have given the amount of irradiation it receives from its host star. And note that the solar system is shown for scale, the interterrestrial planets on the right. And so the first thing you'll notice from this movie is that there are many, many exoplanetary systems with planets that are in orbits much, much smaller than those we see in our solar system. It actually is quite strange that our solar system does not have a planet interior to Mercury. It seems like most planetary systems do have planets that close in with periods less than around 80 days. Additionally, it's strange that our solar system does not have a massive planet close in. And most notably, our solar system does not have a planet in between the size of Earth and the size of Neptune or Uranus, a so-called super-Earth or sub-Neptune exoplanet. And one of the key findings of the Kepler mission is that planets that are between the size of Earth and the ice giants are actually the most common type of planet in the galaxy. And so our solar system is unique for a variety of reasons. And that's, I believe, the key finding of the Kepler mission. There's a couple other critical ways that astronomers study exoplanets, but one that's very important for understanding the atmospheres of planets is the direct imaging method, where a coronagraph is used to block the light from the host star and infer the presence of planets around the host star, in this case, by just directly seeing the light from the planets around it. This is the only method where we actually directly take a picture of exoplanets. And this can only be done at present for exoplanets that are very massive and very young because they're still hot and bright from formation. And so here I'm showing you two detections of exoplanet systems with the direct imaging method. These are actually not just stills, these are movies, because we now have years of observation of these systems. On the left, this is the HR8799 system, which is a nearly face-on system of four super Jupiter planets. And on the right, this is the Beta Pictoris system, which is one single planet that is in a fairly edge-on geometry with respect to our line of sight. And this system also importantly has a debris disk within it. And the planet warps the debris disk. And actually the planet was predicted to be in the system by observing the warping of the debris disk. So at present, we have a kind of three main ways to characterize planets. There's a fourth I didn't describe, which is microlensing, which is a powerful statistical technique. And at present, right, we've found more than 5,000 planets. I just want to kind of walk through our current understanding. So this will be a movie showing you the planet population over time. This will show you planet mass as a function of orbital period on the left, and then the number of planets as a function of radius on the right. This will be a histogram kind of summarizing the results. And this movie was made by Aaron May, who is a research scientist at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. So let's step through. First, we're here in 1995, where we just have two systems found by radial velocities. And you'll see in the 90s, most of the detections were via radial velocities. And then in 2000, the first transit observation was done for the planet HD 209458b. And now you can see that due to the Kepler and TESS missions, the vast majority of planets have been found by the transit method with radial velocity second and direct imaging and microlensing comparable. You can see that these different methods provide information about planets in different regions of parameter space. Transit is biased towards finding planets that are very close in, whereas radial velocity finds planets over a wide range of orbital period, especially because we now have such a long baseline of radial velocity observations, whereas direct imaging more easily finds planets that are further out in systems. Okay, so now with kind of that context, I'll describe research into studying the atmospheres of exoplanets. This talk will be kind of split into two avenues. One, studying hot Jupiters, because these planets are the largest planets that are the closest in, and so they have the greatest signal to study. These are, I would say, the only planet that we have a fairly robust understanding of the atmospheres of at present. And then terrestrial exoplanets are kind of the frontier of studying exoplanet atmospheric circulation. And I'll kind of describe how we can use theory to guide our search for potentially habitable planets with surface liquid water. So hot Jupiters are planets that we expect to be very, very different than our own Jupiter. And the reason why is because though this planet we expect will be somewhat Jupiter-like in terms of its mass and radius, due to the close orbital separations between hot Jupiters and the host star, we expect them to have a very different spin state and a resulting very different atmospheric circulation. Because hot Jupiters are so close into their host star, we expect them to be tidally locked, much like the moon is to Earth, with a day side that always sees the host star and a night side that is in perpetual nighttime, never sees any host starlight. And so as a result of this large day to night irradiation contrast, we expect there to be a resulting large day to night pressure gradient, which drives strong atmospheric circulation, shown here by the green lines, that balances the large day to night pressure gradient. And just simple scaling theory, first done over 20 years ago now, estimates that these winds should be on the order of kilometers per second. So an order of magnitude faster than any winds on any planet in our solar system. And we can study the atmospheres of hot Jupiters through three different types of observation. The primary observational technique to probe the atmospheric composition of planets is transmission spectroscopy. And this takes advantage of the transit method. So it's effectively the same science as the transit method. But if you look at the transit as a function of wavelength, then one can infer the relative size of the planet compared to the size of the star as a function of wavelength, which in principle, if the planet has an atmosphere, tells you about the relative size of the atmosphere at different wavelengths, i.e. how absorptive the atmosphere is at different wavelengths. And this can be linked to the atmospheric composition because the planet will appear larger at wavelengths where given molecules like water vapor or carbon dioxide absorb in the planet's atmosphere. And so by seeing these increased transit depths at given wavelengths of absorption, you can infer the atmospheric composition. The second primary observational technique is studying the planet rather than at primary transit, studying it at secondary eclipse when the planet is occulted by its host star. And if you see a change in the planet plus star flux at secondary eclipse, you can then subtract out from before and eclipse and then the center of eclipse to isolate the difference, which is necessarily the flux from the planet itself. And so from this secondary eclipse depth, one can construct an emission spectrum of the light from the planet directly. And then lastly, one can take a full phase curve of the planet as it orbits its host star. That is just a light curve of the planet plus star flux over one full orbital phase of the planet in order to infer the phase dependence of the planetary emitted flux. And so enter JWST. At this point, we now have observations from JWST that are published for two different hot Jupiter exoplanets that I'll walk through. And JWST has already revolutionized our understanding of exoplanet atmospheres because it's effectively 100 times better than the Hubble Space Telescope. First off, JWST has a larger mirror. Its mirror is 6.6 meters compared to Hubble's 2.4 meters. And this gives you about a little bit less than 10 times more photons than Hubble for the same observing time. But then more importantly, right, JWST is at the L2 point. And so it can be, first off, always observing a given planetary system, you know, over orbital phase. It doesn't have to deal with the fact that there'll be systematics affecting the observations as the telescope orbits Earth, like we have to deal with for Hubble. And so we naturally expect the telescope to be more precise. But secondly, right, the telescope is cooled by the fact that it has a sun shield that is blocking light from the sun-facing side and keeping the detectors cold in order to do science observations. And the detectors, in most cases, are simply passively cooled by the sun shield, but there's also a mid-infrared instrument, MIRI, which is actively cooled. And so JWST has a much broader wavelength coverage than HST. For exoplanets, we use HST observations covering from the near UV to the near infrared, about 1.7 microns. Whereas JWST for exoplanet observations can go into about 18 microns and in the mid-IR. And so we get about an order of magnitude increase in our wavelength coverage as well. And so when you put together the increased size of the telescope plus the increased wavelength coverage, JWST is about 100 times better than Hubble. You can also get another factor of 10 from the fact that you are able to more persistently observe. And so JWST simply blows the existing instruments out of the water. And so here I'm showing you the early release science observation of the hot Jupiter WASP 39b with JWST. This is using the near spec instrument covering around 0.5 microns to 5 microns in one single continuous observation. And so the top plot here is just showing you the transit of this planet at three different wavelength bins. One at 3 microns, one at 4.3 microns, and one at 4.7 microns. And so you can see at each of these wavelength bins, you can see the same general transit event where the starlight is not changing until the planet blocks the star. And then you see this characteristic dip and then increase as the planet transits its host star. However, the 4.3 micron bin is right at the center of a carbon dioxide absorption feature. And so if carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere of this planet, we would expect to see a larger transit depth, which corresponds to a larger planet size at the wavelength where carbon dioxide absorbs. And indeed, if you do zoom in and look at the transit itself, you can see that the brightness is a little smaller in the 4.3 micron bin than the 4.7 or 3.0 micron bin, implying that the planet is indeed blocking more of its host star light in the wavelength at which carbon dioxide absorbs, which then implies that carbon dioxide is present in this planet's atmosphere. And so by doing this same sort of observation over broad wavelength coverage with four different instruments, we as the JWST early release science team were able to put together four different spectra of WASP-39b that all agree and overlap with one another. So these are spectra I'm showing you from the NIRIS instrument, which observes in the near infrared from around 0.6 to 2.9 microns. The NIRCam instrument, one specific observing mode that is fairly high resolution and only covers from around 2.5 to 4 microns. The bottom left is showing you the NIRIS spec instrument, the G395H GRISM, which observes centered on 3.95 microns, going out in the red to around 5.5 microns and down to around 2.7 microns. And then the bottom right shows the PRISM, which has a wavelength coverage that is much greater than all these other instruments and encompasses all of the other instruments' wavelength coverage, but at cost of a lower resolution. So this goes from around 0.5 to 5.5 microns. And you can see that there's just a wealth of information contained in these spectra. There are many, many absorption features that we detected. The most prominent one is the CO2 absorption feature, which you can see very clearly in the near-spec G395H spectrum and the near-spec PRISM spectrum. So this feature is centered at 4.3 microns. But there's also features of water, which are very prominent, at 1.4 microns and around 2 microns and around 2.8 microns, seen with NIRCam, NIRSpec, and NIRIS, all three instruments. And then additionally, there's this very surprising discovery of sulfur dioxide in this atmosphere, which was seen with NIRSpec PRISM and NIRSpec G395H. And the reason that this is surprising is that it was not expected from kind of a priori models for the planet's atmosphere that assumed chemical equilibrium. That is that the atmosphere is in a state of thermochemical equilibrium where reaction rates balance and all species, their abundance is simply set by the temperature and pressure conditions. So what this implies is that there's some sort of chemical disequilibrium in the atmosphere of WASP-39b. And there's a paper that's in press that is showcasing that the sulfur dioxide that we observe can be explained by photochemistry in the atmosphere of WASP-39b. So this is the first evidence of photochemistry in an exoplanet atmosphere. However, with JWST, we have not published any full phase curve observations yet. This is in the works for one planet, WASP-39b. So for phase curve observations, we now kind of have to turn back the clock and think about observations from the early 2010s with the Hubble Space Telescope. And this is actually will be followed up in the next few months with JWST. The observations are already taken and they're being analyzed. But here I'll just show you kind of what the previous state of the art was for studying planetary emission with HST. So this will show you in the top left, the emission spectrum of WASP-43b from 1.1 to 1.7 microns, which covers a broad water feature centered around 1.4 microns. The bottom are going to be brightness temperature maps of the planet, and the top right will be a thermal structure of the planet that is inferred from a model. And so you can see as the planet's day side comes into view near an orbital phase of 0.5, there's this clear water absorption feature in the emission spectrum. And you can also see that the planet is physically brighter, has a greater brightness temperature, and we retrieve a higher temperature on the day sides of the planet. And the night side of this planet was actually not detected with HST, which is something we hope to improve with JWST. So this is kind of the current state of the art pre-JWST for emission spectra of hot Jupiters. And note that there's also pre-JWST been a wide range of studies of hot Jupiters as a population, especially with the Spitzer Space Telescope, which observed phase curves for more than 30 hot Jupiters. And here I'm showing you a summary plot of on the top, the day side brightness temperature, and on the bottom, the night side brightness temperature of the sample of hot Jupiters as a function of their irradiation temperature, which is again, just a prescription for how much stellar flux they're receiving. And you can see, generally speaking, the day side temperature correlates very strongly with the irradiation temperature, which you would naturally expect. If the planet receives more flux, it should have a hotter day side. But the night side follows this trend a little less strongly, which implies that the day-to-night temperature contrasts of hot Jupiters grow as they receive more incident flux. So the planets become a little bit less efficient at transporting heat from their day sides to their night sides as they receive more incident stellar radiation. And in the ultra-hot Jupiter regime, the day-night temperature contrast can exceed 1,000 Kelvin. So these are enormous contrasts in kind of the properties of the atmosphere between day and night side. likely also causing changes in the chemistry of the atmosphere between the day side and the night side. And so these observations have compelled a broad range of modeling work that has been developed to understand the circulation of hot Jupiters. Here, I'm showing you a variety of models, but I first want you to turn your attention to the top left here. So this is showing, this image in the top left is showing an observation of the exoplanet HD189733b from Spitzer. This is kind of the inferred brightness temperature map. The very first model ever published for the 3D atmospheric circulation of a hot Jupiter by Shoman and Guillot, 2002. And the most prominent prediction of this model is that the planet will have a strong eastward jet of winds that are on the order of a kilometer per second in speed, that blow the hottest point of the planet downwind by a few tens of degrees in longitude. And this would be observable through a shift in the longitude of peak brightness in the phase curve. And indeed, that's exactly what was observed in the first observation of a phase curve of a hot Jupiter with Spitzer. And so as a result of kind of this success, there's been a wide range of model predictions for the atmospheric circulation of hot Jupiters. I'm just showing you a selection of them here. And they all kind of agree in the basic picture of the atmospheric circulation of hot Jupiters, where you have fast kilometer per second winds and these eastward hotspot offsets that can affect phase curve observations. They also all agree that hot Jupiter should have large day to night temperature contrasts with night sides that can be over 1,000 Kelvin cooler than the day side. And so these models have been really tested in recent years by observations of the hottest hot Jupiters, the so-called ultra-hot Jupiters. And these planets are very challenging for our current understanding of hot Jupiters because their spectra are challenging to interpret. So here I'm showing you an observation of the emission spectrum of the ultra-hot Jupiter HAT-P7b with both the Hubble Space Telescope shown in the inset and the Spitzer Space Telescope observing in the further IR. And the observations for this planet are confounding because there are no clear absorption or emission features in the atmosphere at all. Instead, they just look like a black body. They're very well fit by a simple black body model. They're not well fit at all by our kind of standard picture of a decreasing temperature profile, which would lead to strong water absorption features. And so the puzzle of ultra-hot Jupiters has persisted. And that's why the JWST early release science team decided to study an ultra-hot Jupiter with its kind of case of an emission spectrum. And so here I'm showing you an emission spectrum of the ultra-hot Jupiter WASP-18b with the JWST NIRAS SAS instrument. This is the instrument that studies the very near infrared, covering around 0.8 to 2.7 microns. And this instrument, it has a slitless spectrograph, so it is optimized to studying very bright stars, of which WASP-18 is. Many ultra-hot Jupiters are ultra-hot because they orbit very bright stars in very close orbits. And so here I'm showing you this spectrum is a brightness temperature spectrum as a function of wavelength. So converting the planet to star flux ratio into brightness temperature in order to better see spectral features. And the different black points are all of the JWST spectrum. And this is compared with the TESS photometric point at 0.8 microns and two Spitzer photometric points at 3.6 and 4.5 microns. And the first thing that's important to note in the spectrum is that there are clear features, there are clear bumps in the spectrum, which we could not resolve with the Hubble Space Telescope. So this right away told us that our simple picture that we had with Hubble was incorrect. There actually are features in this atmosphere. In this case, they are bumps, so they are emission features. And what this implies is that the atmosphere of the planet is thermally inverted. So the temperature profile is such that the temperatures increase as one goes towards higher altitudes. And this is likely driven by the absorption of starlight by optical opacity sources in this atmosphere. And this is just showing a best model fit where we included the optical opacity source of titanium oxide, which is you know, known to be an optical opacity from human experience because we can use it, or it has been used in the past as sunscreen, though it's no longer used in most sunscreens. And then we also can include the optical opacity of H minus, that is hydrogen that has first been dissociated from molecular to atomic form and then ionized. And this is showing largely bound-free emission features of H minus can also reproduce this optical slope that we see in the spectrum. And so from the spectrum, there's clear evidence for water vapor emission features that are covering between around 1.4 microns to 3 microns. There's potentially evidence for carbon monoxide at 4.5 microns. And there's further evidence for the combined effect of H minus and titanium oxide, and perhaps also vanadium oxide, another metal oxide, causing optical opacity that causes enhanced emission in the optical. And this is a very exciting first glimpse at the emission of ultra-hot Jupiters. And I would say so far, it's already changed our perspective, but there's significant work to do moving forward, especially for this individual planet. This paper at present is posted in our archive, but it is not accepted yet. We're currently in the review process at Nature. Okay, so in the last 15 minutes or so, I'm going to switch gears and talk about rocky exoplanets that might be somewhat Earth-like, so kind of thinking more towards the future. So there's been a wide range of work studying the climates of Earth-like exoplanets, even though at present we have very little observational constraints on them. And the reason why is, of course, it's a very exciting and compelling science topic to understand the climates of planets that are Earth-like, but perhaps very different planetary parameters. Perhaps they orbit different host star types than Earth. Perhaps they're more quickly rotating or more slowly rotating. Perhaps they're a little bit larger or a little bit smaller. And each of those effects will slightly change their atmospheric circulation. And so this is just a schematic drawn by Adam Shoman that just kind of reviews the key features of Earth's atmospheric circulation. So Earth's atmospheric circulation is driven by the fact that Earth receives more radiation at the equator than it does at the pole on an annual average. So this leads to a pressure gradient, which triggers circulation that acts to reduce the equator to pole contrast and emitted flux. And indeed, we do see, right, there's a decrease in the equator to pole contrast on Earth relative to what there would be if there were no atmospheric circulation. And this equator to pole heat contrast is largely caused by two main types of circulation. The first one are the Hadley cells, which are cells that include rising motion due to convection in the tropics and then descending motion in the extratropics, which cause the deserts of, for example, Arizona and the Sahara. And then poleward of the Hadley cells, the heat transport is accomplished by smaller scale circulation that we term eddies because they are not part of the east-west average circulation. And these eddies, generally speaking, are like tongues of air, and they're associated, right, with the varying high pressure and low pressure systems that we experience regularly in Maryland and the DC area. But note that exoplanets need not have Earth-like circulations, and this is especially the case if rocky exoplanets orbit stars that are much smaller and cooler than our own sun. And so here I'm showing you simulations of the atmospheric circulation of Earth-sized exoplanets with an Earth-like atmosphere orbiting two different host star types. So the top is showing an Earth-like planet orbiting a sun-like star, and the bottom is showing an Earth-like planet orbiting an M-dwarf star with an orbit that has an orbital period of around 60 days, such that it receives a little bit more stellar radiation than Earth, but it has a fairly similar overall average surface temperature of 279 Kelvin. And in this model for the planet orbiting an M-dwarf star, it's assumed that the planet is tightly locked to its host star because its orbital separation is very small, around a tenth of an AU. And you can see that the resulting circulation is very different between the Earth-like model and the model of an Earth-sized planet orbiting an M-dwarf star. In the Earth-like model, the largest contrasts in temperature are from equator to pole, whereas for the model of an Earth-sized planet orbiting an M-dwarf star, the largest temperature contrasts are from day side to night side, just like for hot Jupiters. And the right-hand side is showing a plot of the cloud fraction from these models. And you can see in the Earth-like case, most of the clouds are in the tropics and in the ITZZ, just like there is on present day Earth. Whereas for the rocky planet orbiting an M-dwarf star, there's an enormous cloud deck that covers the entire day side of the planet, which is driven by deep convection due to the fact that the planet is always receiving irradiation at its substellar point, and so it's very moist there, and there's a significant amount of water vapor that can condense at low pressures. And it's been proposed that these dayside cloud decks of planets that orbit M-dwarf stars can actually change our expectations for the habitable zone. And so the habitable zone is kind of a fundamental concept for where we might expect planets that are Earth-like in all respects. They have a size similar to Earth. They have an Earth-like atmospheric composition, where we can expect these planets to have surface liquid water that persists over long timescales. And so the classic way it's shown is kind of dictated by inner and outer edges of the habitable zone, where if one is inward of the inner edge, closer to the star, water vapor would be lost to space and eventually the planet would become desiccated. Or if the planet is further away than the outer edge of the habitable zone, water would not be able to be present in liquid form. It would be too cold and it would be all locked up in ice. The y-axis of this plot is showing the temperature of the star that the planet is assumed to be orbiting around, and the x-axis is showing the instant stellar flux. And so the inner and the outer edges that were predicted from previous 1D models, not including this dayside cloud feedback, predicted that, you know, Earth itself would just barely be habitable or potentially not, depending on how exactly one parameterizes clouds. But going to 3D models, first off, the cloud effect itself enables Earth to be habitable because clouds on Earth do indeed increase our planetary albedo. But as you go towards these models that are slowly rotating or assume tidal locking, the inner edge of the habitable zone moves significantly further in. And this is because these dayside clouds significantly increase the albedo of the planet and allow the surface to stay temperate at far higher values of instant stellar flux. And so this is a very exciting prospect for exoplanet characterization, because this means that there might be a panoply of potentially habitable rocky exoplanets orbiting nearby M-dwarf stars. However, there's a bit of a conundrum in that the same cloud deck that is amazing for potentially promoting habitable surface conditions greatly impacts our observations. And this is because as we go towards these rocky exoplanets that orbit M-dwarf stars, their atmospheric circulation is such that they have these large day-to-night Hadley cell-like circulation structures where there's rising motion on the day side and sinking motion on the night side. And this leads to the transport of clouds to the limb of the planet, which is exactly where we want to probe in transmission spectra. Here I'm just showing you some simulations by Gabby Suisa, who was a postdoc at Goddard. And this is just showing the amount of clouds, ice cloud on top and liquid cloud on the bottom, as a function of pressure on the y-axis and latitude on the x-axis. And you can see, especially for planets that orbit earlier M-dwarf stars, these so-called intermediate or slower rotator planets, these planets have very, very high cloud decks that would be in Earth's stratosphere. And these high ice cloud decks kind of prohibit our understanding of the atmospheres of these planets via transmission spectroscopy. Here's just kind of a schematic showing how clouds can affect our inferences from transmission spectroscopy. This is from Eliza Kempton's News and Views in 2014 for a paper on the exoplanet GJ1214b. Effectively, if we have clouds that are high in the atmosphere, they block the passage of starlight through the planetary limb, which is the effect that we want to probe via transmission spectroscopy. And so we see a smaller change in the absorption of starlight as a function of pressure, because there's basically a floor beneath which we cannot probe the atmosphere. Meanwhile, if there's no clouds or a very deep cloud deck, then we can see strong features because the starlight is able to be filtered through the entire planetary limb. And I've also worked on this problem, and I had a similar finding to the Suisa et al. Result on the left, which is that as the rotation of tidally locked rocky exoplanets slows, there's a strong transition in their dynamical regime at a rotation period of around 10 days that can lead to very muted spectral features in atmospheres that are like Earth, especially spectral features of water, which is the key habitability indicator. to study the climates of rocky exoplanets. Okay, so in the last 5 minutes or so, I'm going to kind of just talk about the future of exoplanet science, kind of thinking beyond JWST. So with JWST, we're hoping to kind of probe the atmospheres of rocky exoplanets in a bit more detail, maybe see some absorption features, for example, due to carbon dioxide, which is less affected by clouds, or methane, in the case that these planets do potentially have a biosphere. But for really characterizing the climates of rocky planets in detail, we need to think about future facilities. And these are facilities that can directly image rocky exoplanets, either orbiting nearby M-dwarf stars or orbiting sun-like stars. And so in the coming decade, I'm very excited about the advent of the extremely large ground-based telescopes, which will have high-resolution spectrographs that enable the characterization of the atmospheric compositions of rocky exoplanets in the habitable zones of nearby M-dwarf stars. And then further into the future, NASA has begun the process of kind of outlining the mission concept of the Habitable Worlds Observatory, which grew out of the LOVOIR and the HABEX mission concepts. And this mission would be effectively the successor to JWST, would launch in the mid-2040s, would have a mirror pretty comparable in size to JWST, but would observe in the UV and optical, and would have the ability to, when using a coronagraph, block out the light from sun-like stars that are within around 20 parsecs and isolate the reflected light of an Earth-like planet at 1 AU from that sun-like star. So this is an example. This is a simulated image of our solar system from a LOVOIR or a Habitable Worlds Observatory-like mission, showing that you could actually infer the reflected light directly of Earth, Venus, and Jupiter of our solar system if it were at a distance of 10 parsecs from us. And so looking towards the far future, this is kind of our main avenue towards studying the atmospheric circulation, climate, and potential for habitability of truly Earth-like planets orbiting sun-like stars, rather than Earth-sized planets orbiting M-dwarf stars. And one very powerful technique that can be used with these observations is rotational phase mapping. So we can study the reflected light of the planet as a function of rotational phase in order to infer its surface distribution. So, right, due to the different albedos of ocean and continent, and also by utilizing the fact that we could see glint if there's a specular reflection off of the ocean, we can infer basically a longitudinal dependence of the brightness of the planet, and thereby infer how much continent there is versus ocean as a function of rotational phase. This is just an example from Cowan et al. 2009, but there's been more recent work along this avenue. But then lastly, we really want to infer the atmospheric composition of exoplanets with this method through spectroscopy. But one thing to note that while we do this, right, we might not be seeing Earth-like planets as they are today, because modern Earth with our very high amount of oxygen is only a very small part of Earth as a whole, right? We've only been at our present oxygen level since the Cambrian explosion around 580 million years ago. And before that, oxygen levels were over an order of magnitude lower during the boring billion and the Neo-Proterozoic. And before that, right, oxygen levels were very low before the great oxidation event around 2.5 billion years ago. And so the Archean Earth looks very different than the Proterozoic Earth, which looks very different than the modern Earth. And so in principle, if you want to study planets that have life through spectroscopy, we need to be cognizant of the fact that we might observe planets that are more like Proterozoic Earth than modern Earth and be able to distinguish between these biospheres. And so importantly, the Habitable Worlds Observatory can do this. It could actually distinguish the relative reflected light spectrum between these different Earth-like conditions. So here I'm showing you the simulated reflectance spectrum with this observatory from around 0.25 to 2 microns. So this would be a spiritual successor to Hubble in terms of its wavelength range. And you can see with these observations, you can infer the presence of ozone through its near UV absorption. You can infer the presence of oxygen and visible. You can also infer the presence of key habitability indicators like water and carbon dioxide through near infrared observations. And so I'm very much looking forward to a future in which we can characterize the atmospheres of planets that are actually Earth-like, orbiting sun-like stars. Okay, so just to summarize, in the coming decade, JWST will revolutionize our understanding of hot and ultra-hot Jupiters and also a variety of other planets going down to sub-Neptunes and super-Earths as well. And it will also constrain the climates of Earth-sized exoplanets that orbit small, cool M-dwarf stars. But looking towards the future, a large direct imaging mission like the Habitable Worlds Observatory will enable the study of the reflected light of Earth-like planets orbiting sun-like stars. And that's all. Thank you very much for your attention. And I'm happy to take any questions people have.
Feel free to unmute yourself and clap.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is Susan Schiffman. How many elements have you ever seen from exoplanets?
Yeah, that's a great question. So,
and what's the largest one? Well, what's the largest molecule?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. So in terms of elements, most of the heavy element characterization of exoplanets has come from the a different technique than what I described in this talk. This is a technique where one studies the very, very high resolution spectra of exoplanets with ground-based telescopes, for example, Keck and Gemini, using spectrographs that have a resolving power of around 100,000 spectrally. And so you can resolve individual lines of different species. And so that technique has been used to find exotic, and my opinion as a low-res astronomer in most cases, elements like yttrium in the atmospheres of ultra-hot Jupiters. It's also been used to find other atomic metal species like iron and other metal oxides like titanium oxide. And basically, this high-resolution technique is the way to like conclusively identify kind of exotic elemental species in these atmospheres. Does that answer your question?
Well, what percent of the ones that we know?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure like what percent of elements have been found using high-res spectroscopy. I'd have to like look at a review paper by Jens Hojemakers, who's kind of like the guru of high-res spectroscopy. But I could definitely get that to you. I guess I would say in terms of the overall periodic table, it's probably on the order of like a couple dozen elements have been detected.
That's okay. How about methane? How many of these have methane?
Oh, this is a long-standing conundrum. So for hot exoplanets that have a metallicity that is similar to our sun, we would expect methane to be not usually present. We would expect it to only become common in thermochemical equilibrium for cooler planets that have temperatures of around 800 or 900 Kelvin or lower. But generally speaking, for even planets where we expect to see methane in thermochemical equilibrium, we do not. There's only one instance that is unpublished that I saw at a AAAS talk of an observation of methane in the atmosphere of a warm Jupiter with an equilibrium temperature of around 800 Kelvin. And we don't see it on the night sides of hot Jupiters, and we often don't see it at all in the atmospheres of cooler planets that are sub-Neptunes. And it's thought that the reason that methane is so challenging to detect is twofold. One is that these planets could have hotter interiors that destroys methane just due to thermochemical conversion at depth and chemical equilibrium. But secondly, also, right, many of these planets orbit very close into their host stars. And so photochemistry could destroy methane, liberate the hydrogen and allow for complex hydrocarbons to form and also cause the formation of hazes, very similar to Titan. And indeed, high altitude haze layers have been seen on many sub-Neptunes, and there's also inferences for them on hot Jupiters as well. And so it's likely that methane is commonly destroyed via photochemistry, which is why we don't see it very often.
Terrific talk.
Thanks.
A question. This is on the origin of the hot Jupiters. I take it these are actual planets which formed, which wandered in for whatever dynamical reasons. Could some of them be failed binaries? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's a great question. So In terms of the formation, there's three possible pathways. The first one is they could form in situ, where we see them today. That's very unlikely because there's likely not enough metal mass in the protoplanetary disks at those semi-major axes to form a core, which then accretes gas through the canonical core accretion paradigm for gas giant planets. And so it's thought that it's most likely that hot Jupiters form farther out beyond the ice lines in the disk, where there's a significant amount of solids like water that can form the cores of the planets. And then after they form, they migrate in closer to the host star. And there's two different ways that they can move towards the host star. The first one is they can migrate within the disk itself through the type two migration process, where they open up a gap in the disk, and then the torques between the disk and the planet cause it to migrate inwards. The second possibility is that these planets instead are scattered in later due to the gravitational influence of external companions, like another star in the system or a further out gas giant that causes it to have its eccentricity excited through Kozai lead-off cycles. And then due to the eccentricity being excited as it gets to high enough values, it will eventually have a small enough pericenter to feel tidal effects from its star, which can circularize its orbit with a smaller semi-major axis. And so I would say there's no clear distinction as to whether one of these formation pathways is the dominant pathway. It seems like at present, the current understanding is that there are multiple formation pathways, likely a combination of dismigration and scattering. And there's a very nice review by Becky Dawson and John Johnson from 2018. This is an annual reviews of astronomy and astrophysics that goes through each of the pathways and the evidence for them explaining different parts of the population of hot Jupiters. But yeah, it's likely some combination. In terms of whether or not hot Jupiters could be failed binary stars, that seems very unlikely that they formed through gravitational collapse. In most cases, hot Jupiters are low enough mass that we don't think that they form like stars. We think that they're planets. But there are some massive brown dwarfs that orbit very close in to sun-like stars, like KELT-1b is one example of this. This is an ultra-hot, well, we call it an ultra-hot Jupiter, but it's really an ultra-hot brown dwarf that has a mass of dozens of Jupiter masses. And in that case, yes, that could have formed like a binary star through gravitational collapse and then migrated inwards to its present orbit.
I had a question. It seems to me that the, and I was wondering if you agree, that the transit method has sort of a bias that it can pretty much only tend to detect very close planets. Because if you look at, if you take a model of orbiting planets in a plane and you rotate it so that it's very, at various angles, that it's going to detect very close in planets. Would you agree?
Yes, certainly. And clearly the evidence bears that out, right? If we look at the population of planets found via different detection methods, transits is the method that is biased towards finding planets at the closest separations, shortest orbital periods. Okay. And that the probability of detecting a planet via transit, given that we don't know its inclination a priori, is it scales as the size of the star divided by the planet-star separation. And so, yeah, the probability of seeing the planet scales inversely with the separation. So you naturally expect, yes, it's more challenging to find planets via transit with further orbits. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Just a comment about those migrating planets. That seems to have occurred in our own solar system, and with Jupiter and Saturn having migrated inward and then back outward due to dynamical gravitational effects. But that's also supposed to be responsible for the asteroid belt.
Yes, that's the Grand TAC model for solar system formation.
So does our system seem unusual then, or is it, or would we expect to see other mass distributions similar to ours?
Sorry, what was the first part of the question?
Is our solar system therefore unusual, or is it just that we haven't detected that particular type? It's more difficult to detect that particular type of mass distribution.
Yeah, good question. So if you can like mentally draw our solar system onto this, right, you can see that Jupiter with its 5AU separation, we can detect Jupiter's now with the radial velocity method. We're getting to that point. Saturn, maybe just barely. Uranus and Neptune, definitely not right now, just because we don't have a long enough baseline to see them. And so that already limits, right, half of the giant planets in our solar system we could not detect with current technology, just because we need longer observation baselines. We also can't quite see Earth yet, right? Like Earth is down here on the diagram. We definitely cannot detect Mars. Mercury is marginal. We probably could detect Mercury. And Venus, we could detect a Venus-like planet. So, right, if you sum that all up, that's half of the planets in the solar system we could actually see at present. And so all of our inferences about whether or not the solar system or a solar system-like architecture is common comes from taking our current observations and attempting to de-bias them, right? Because we know how these observations are biased. We know, for example, how the transit probability scales with semi-major axis. We know how the radial velocity semi-amplitude scales with orbital period and planet mass. And so we can try to infer from the current populations what the actual populations might be, but right, you cannot really extrapolate from what we have. It's really only a way to better understand how to de-bias within this cloud that we have at present. And so I would say, yeah, we don't really know whether or not our solar system is common. We do know that gas giant planets are far more common beyond the snow line at separations greater than around 2AU than they are close in their host stars. Hot Jupiters are actually intrinsically very rare objects and only occur around less than 1% of sun-like stars. And so it's likely that gas giants in the orbital regions where we see them in our solar system are more common in exoplanet systems. We just need basically longer baseline observations to really understand whether or not that is the case in detail.
Thank you.
Excellent talk. On that histogram, I have a couple questions. First, on that histogram of the radius, it has an extremely obvious bimodal distribution. And is that real? No. And if so, what would cause that?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yes, that is real. Of course, there's detection bias in like the peak here. It's easier to see the giant planets. But right, the fact that you see another peak at smaller radius, even though there's detection bias, implies that yes, this is a real bimodal distribution where the kind of two most common types of exoplanets are firstly, super Earth or sub-Neptune exoplanets, which is the smaller peak. And then secondly, the gas giant exoplanets, which are the larger peak. And I would say our surveys aren't really complete down to Earth radius and smaller. And so we don't really know whether there could be, you know, another peak at a Mars size. We just don't know right now. But the reason why there's this decrease as you go from the sub-Neptunes to the giants is because it's very hard to put more and more gas on a planet that is a, you know, Neptune-sized object without it becoming a giant planet in the process of formation, because the core accretion instability that causes giant planets to accrete so much gas in their surroundings and very rapidly grow to be, you know, hundreds of Earth masses, that happens if the planet gets to around 10 Earth masses. And so we don't expect to see many planets that are around, you know, like the 10 to 50 Earth mass range, because they would very rapidly grow to gas giant planets. And then secondly, even if somehow those planets did, you know, exist with those massive atmospheres on rocky cores that didn't quite undergo a core accretion runaway and become gas giants, even if they did exist, we expect that when the planet is young, its surface will be very hot and likely will be molten for some time during a magma ocean phase. And hydrogen is very reactive with exposed magma. And so Neptune-sized planets or more massive planets that have exposed melted rock on the surface with hydrogen atmosphere overlying it can basically ingas the hydrogen from the atmosphere. And so this would cause the radius to appear smaller for a given mass. And this is the proposed, you know, sub-Neptune cliff. It's been proposed by Edwin Kite due to the ingassing of the hydrogen helium envelope by exposed magma.
Very interesting. Thank you. My other question then, on your plot of the evolution of oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere there over time, there seem to be several curves. Yes, that one. Then, so what are the different curves there?
There's sort of
an orange one, a blue one, possibly a pink one.
Yeah, that's a good point. So this is a schematic showing different isotope records for from which you can indirectly infer the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. And the primary record, which is shown by like the purple and the orangish lines, comes from sulfur isotopes. So by measuring the relative abundance of the three different sulfur isotopes, I believe it's 34, 35, and 37, over time, you can infer the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. And this is because if there's not a significant amount of oxygen in the atmosphere, the sulfur isotopes are fractionated. So their proportions are set through photochemistry in the atmosphere. Whereas if there is a significant amount of oxygen, the sulfur isotopes are fractionated simply depending on their mass. So the more massive ones are more likely to be locked up through distillation processes. And so, yeah, mostly this record comes from sulfur isotope measurements that were actually pioneered by James Farquhar, who's the chair of the geology department at the University of Maryland. And then the other measurements are basically inferences of the amount of oxygen from dissolved oxygen in water on the surface. Basically these like oxygen oases that we see at the late Archean, which are the evidence for these whiffs, and potentially also evidence for this overshoot of the amount of oxygen during the great oxidation event. But yeah, the primary inference is sulfur isotopes, and there's a few other ways to infer the oxygen over time.
Okay, so why is there that long flat plateau between about 2.2 and 0.6 or so billion years ago?
Yeah, that's the boring billion, the neo-proterozoic, where oxygen was around 1/100th of its present value. Yeah. And that's just simply because it took a very, very long time for life on Earth to switch from simply being oxygenic microbial life and plant life to then actually becoming complex multicellular life during the Cambrian explosion. This is simply just a byproduct of evolution being very, very slow.
Oh.
Yeah.
Would any of the sulfur dioxide be volcanic?
Oh, that we're observing on WAS-39 or for Earth?
No, well, it clearly is true for Earth, but for exoplanets.
Yeah, so for WAS-39, it's a gas giant planet, and so we anticipate there's no exposed rock, because as you go deeper and deeper into the planet, eventually, right, you'll reach a region where rock is more or less miscible with hydrogen and helium. And so it's likely that as you get to near the core of WAS-39 and other gas giant planets, you can't really think of there being like distinct layers of, you know, a mantle, a crust, an atmosphere. Instead, it's all one fluid that's supercritical. And so it's all well mixed, and it's very, very different than anything on Earth. So there's likely nothing similar to volcanism. There's just convection that transports species.
Thank you.
I have a question on this same chart on the oxygen content. What I'm looking for is the oxygen content of about 30% supposedly occurred around the time of the Carboniferous. And where is that on the chart? Because it looks like the oxygen content is pretty much the same as it is today. And you don't have an increased oxygen.
Yeah, so the Carboniferous is after the Cambrian explosion. It's like somewhere, it's like maybe like 300, 400. I don't know the periods very well. I mostly know the epochs. But it's
about part of 300 million.
Yeah, it's part of this wiggle, right? So it's
okay.
You know, for the purposes of astronomers, I would say, right, you know, Earth's atmosphere, it has changed by factors of a few, as you just noted, right, over the last hundreds of millions of years. But really, in terms of our detection levels, I would say it would be very challenging to actually discern like changes in oxygen abundance by factors of 2 to 5. Instead, we can really do order of magnitude constraints, especially with present observations. And so, yeah, I doubt it would be possible to determine the difference between a Carboniferous Earth and a, you know, Earth in the Holocene at present, but it would definitely be possible to determine the difference between modern Earth and Earth during the Boring Billion or Earth before the Great Oxidation Event.
Carboniferous was right before the Permian, so it's right near the end of the Proterozoic.
Well, I believe they estimate it using things such as the size of insects, which depend on the diffusion of oxygen. And they've done some very interesting things extrapolating from what we know about the fossils, which is a different way of going at it. Thank you. Very interesting talk.
Well, let's thank our speaker again for an absolutely terrific talk.
Absolutely.
Thank you all for the great questions. I appreciate them. Lots to think about.
Yes, thank you very much. It was lovely. Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. I am amazed at the amount of details that people have now been able to extract from all these incredibly distant planets and detect them at all. And now that we can detect their chemistry and their climate and their circulation of gases and so on. It's amazing, just amazing.
And you ain't seen nothing yet. We'll get more information.
I know. And to think that we just invented radio, 120 years ago? It's amazing how far we have come in such a short time. It's amazing.
And I mean, in some cases, the signals are large enough to see with smaller ground-based telescopes. Like I know Elizabeth has worked with students to detect transiting planets with the UMD Observatory.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my EV scope has a program for looking at the transiting exoplanets. Yeah.
Wow.
I have a colleague who is actually running a transit survey with EV scopes. He works with the company. He has a few EV scopes that he sets up and does robotic observing with.
Yeah.
Wow.
All I need is a backyard where I can see something and a sky where I can see something.
Come to Arizona.
We need to do something about the light pollution.
Yes.
Agree.
So March 25th, turn out those lights and get your local institution to turn them out for an hour.
Yeah.
We'll be able to see the Starlink constellations much better.
Yeah, that's another thing we need to work on. Okay. Wonderful talk, Dr. Konchek. Thank you. I'm very, very impressed.
Yes, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Elizabeth?
Yes.
May I take a moment to go off on a tangent here?
It's up to Guy, but yeah.
Okay. In August of 1999, NCA sponsored a trip to Turkey to observe the eclipse. And touring Turkey, it's a wonderful country and wonderful people. And after the eclipse, we were there when the eclipse of, or the earthquake 7.2 hit.
Hmm.
The current earthquake of 7.8, I looked it up. That means it released 8 times the energy of a 7.2 earthquake. And it's in a part of the country that is very inaccessible. And also people who are now living outside, it's winter rather than summer as it was then. Mm. So I would just ask people to be generous about helping with that, because I know a number of us have been to Turkey. I've been there twice for astronomical events, and people were there for the 2006 eclipse as well. And it's, you know, it's always been a very good experience, and they've been very welcoming of the astronomers.
Yeah, I've donated money to several organizations.
Okay. Are there any more questions for, oops. Okay, thank you all very much for coming. And I think we have finished the meeting.
Yes.
Our next meeting will be March 11th. So 1 month from now, March 11th. So we'll see you on March 11th. And we'll actually have, I think, one of our grad students speaking at that one, Alex Dittman.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. So long, all.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.